You may remember from many moons ago, in the first, actually, I think it was the last half of 2016, 20 weeks in 2016, I went back and checked how many lessons there were, 20 lessons on the book of John, and we only went through the first half of the book. Now, there was a reason we stopped at chapter 12, actually several reasons. One, I got tired of preaching through the book of John. If you know me, if you've spent any time in any of the other Bible studies that we do, I am sort of a rabbit when it comes to, or a squirrel when it comes to Bible study. I like to move around and get to different topics. So 20 weeks I felt was sufficient. But there is another reason, and the reason I was able to justify at John chapter 12 is the Holy Week idea. The narrative in John, and John is more of a philosophical writer, as you think about John's gospel. The first 11 chapters are pretty standard fare for the Gospels. You know, you're going through the life of Jesus, and he went to this place, and he did this thing, and he taught these people, and he did this miracle, and it was great, hooray. But there is a narrative switch in John chapter 12, a transition in his Gospel from the story of Jesus in a general sense to the story of Jesus last week. The last section of John, almost half the book, about 40% of the book, is 7 days, 8 days of material. Just really zooms in on the last week of Jesus' life. Now, this is often called Holy Week. That name isn't a biblical name, but I couldn't think of a better name for it. So that's what we're going with. From the triumphal entry to eventually the resurrection on the next Sunday. This is the last week of Jesus' life. The last teachings, the last acts before his crucifixion. And thus, John accords more time in the gospel for these things. John records in this last 6 or 7 days of Jesus' life, this last period of time, he records a lot that the other writers don't record. This long speech that we'll get to in chapters 14, 15, and 16, the other gospel writers don't record. And the other gospel writers do not spend as much time as John does on these last few days of Jesus' life. John really puts a special emphasis on this last period of time before the crucifixion. And so now we're going to go through that. We're going to, over the next who knows how many weeks, it took me 20 weeks to get through 11 chapters, so we could work that out probably. Let's say 15 weeks, surely not 15 weeks, to go through the last 9 chapters of the book of John. We're going to look at that. Now, there is some, at the end of the book of John, there's some after the resurrection stuff. He is resurrected, and then some things happen. Again, that John records that the other writers don't record. John really stands apart from the other Gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they're pretty much the same thing. They just tell the story the same way. They do have some different events, but John really does emphasize a lot of different things in his telling. And the question that we would begin with is, if you knew you would die in a week, what would it change? If I knew that next on Friday I would die, what would I do differently? What would you do differently if you knew you were going to die later this week? And you knew how you were going to die too. Not just that you were going to, there'd still be an element of, I think, anxiety about if you didn't know how. Like, I might get hit by a bus, or I might have a heart attack, or I might be the victim of a bear mauling. Anything could happen, right? But Jesus knew exactly not only that he's going to die, but how exactly. And the things that are going to be involved in that. How would that change your life? And I think the reason that John really focuses in on this last week of Jesus' life, and especially what's typically called the high priestly prayer in John 14, 15, and 16, is because Jesus is taking the time, the last opportunity he has, to impart some vital knowledge to his apostles, to those who are going to carry on the work when he eventually ascends. And so that's what we're going to spend the next chunk of time on. Now, we're going to begin our examination of these final days in chapter 12, John chapter 12. Now, I would encourage you to do this. I have a bad habit of formatting lessons in a weird way. I would encourage you each week, it'll be pretty obvious what we're going to do the next section. This week, we're going to do the first part of John chapter 12. So next week, you know, you need to read the second part of John chapter 12 and maybe the first half of John chapter 13, and you can just have that read and be prepared and ready to go. We're going to look at the first half of John chapter 12, actually really the first three quarters of John chapter 12, and dissect all the various ways that people responded to him. Well, this is setting the stage for this last week. It's a cauldron of emotions, a lot of different intellectual responses and emotional responses. And Jesus demanded that sort of thing, right? Even today, Jesus creates this complex set of responses, that some people respond to Jesus in a very positive, emotional, joyful way. Some people are much more intellectual about it, and they go through the arguments for the resurrection and the deity of Christ, etc. And some people really hate Jesus. Some people are just totally dismissive, right? There's this complex set of responses that people have, and that's what happens in John chapter 12. We see, first of all, hatred and jealousy. Hatred and jealousy among the people. Now, the reading that was read for us a moment ago had a lot of this in there. When the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came, not on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. A lot of people who don't believe in Jesus have sort of a live and let live attitude, right? You believe in Jesus and that's fine. You do your thing and I'll do my thing. And they don't really care. That's not the attitude that they're having, right? They see other people believing in Jesus and they are actively against that. So much so that they view Lazarus as an acceptable collateral damage, right? We need to stop people believing in Jesus. Lazarus is in their way, so let's knock him off. Right, they're essentially talking about assassinating Lazarus through whatever means that they would have done that. But the hatred and the jealousy intrinsically linked in their hearts, right? That they see people believing in Jesus and they want to totally stop it as much as they can stop it. So this other guy that didn't even do anything wrong, he needs to die too. Can you feel the hatred coming out of their hearts in this text? And as they see some other things happen, they see the people, the triumphal entry, and people are very happy about Jesus, and people are following Jesus. And this is sort of the attitude they have amongst themselves. They said to one another, "You see that you are gaining nothing. Look, the world has gone after him." And you can kind of get the sense that they're plotting, right? What are we going to do about this guy? Well, we can kill Lazarus, and we could do some other things. And then some other Pharisees are saying, "It doesn't even matter. We're not gaining anything. People are still following him. We can't do anything about it." There's this bitterness as well in their reaction. Now, while I'm not sure groups are as jealous as the Pharisees were, the hatred of Christianity today still comes from a similar place. Not everybody, of course, but there are people today who hate Jesus and what he stands for, who hate the concept of Christianity, people who blame religion for the world's problems or people's backwards beliefs, people who blame religion for a lot of the stuff that goes wrong in the world. And to be fair, people have done a lot of bad things in the name of Christianity, but that's not Jesus' fault. But this hatred, this bitterness, this resentment, how many people do you know of that dismiss Christians with this same sentiment? Don't talk to that guy. You're not going to gain anything by talking to him. He's one of those Bible-believing nut jobs. Nobody's probably ever said that to you because you're the Bible-believing nut job. But this attitude, right? This is the attitude that people have. Well, not everybody, but some people. Some percentage of the population responds to Jesus with hatred and bitterness and jealousy, just like they did back then. The second response, misguided and mistaken fervor. Now, in John chapter 12, there's a lot of positivity. A lot of things are going well for Jesus. People are liking him. People are treating him well. But remember, I got the week wrong. This isn't going to happen in a week. It's going to happen during this week. Literally happen during the week that follows. What is going to happen within this week? They like him today, but 5 or 6 days from now, there's a mob shouting what? Crucify him! Crucify him! Now, I don't know how many people were in common, but the vast majority of the people in Jerusalem during the next 5 days were very negative towards Jesus, very anti-Jesus. And now they have the fervor here, they have the belief here, they have a lot of positive ideas here, but where did all those people go when he was before Pilate, when he was on the cross? When the large crowd of Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he raised from the dead. Jesus created sort of a mob mentality. And when I say created, I mean he inspired it in people, right? Just his very presence, the things he did. I don't think it was intentional. I just think this is how people are, right? This sort of mob mentality about Jesus. Here he is. Let's go see him. It's almost a groupie mentality, really. You have a famous rock star come into a town. What does everybody do? Let's go see that guy or that person, whoever it is. That's the sort of attitude that people had about Jesus. Now, that was misguided, right? That wasn't the kind of attitude I don't think that Jesus necessarily wanted people to have. We'll look at that as we go through the lesson. But man, if that wasn't the way, he was a rock star in every sense of the word. In that, then the way that we think about famous people today, the way that people flock to them, the way that people want to be around them, that's how people reacted to Jesus. Not everybody, but a lot of people, obviously. Verses 12 through 15, the next day the large crowd that had come to the feast heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, so they took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him, crying, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel." And Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it, just as it is written, "Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt." In what sense did they consider Jesus a king? What did that mean to them? Like Keith pointed out in his talk, there's no way they had any idea what that really meant. What are they thinking of? They're thinking of this person who's going to ride in Jerusalem and he's going to take out the corruption and he's going to restore Israel and he's going to kick out the invaders and he's going to restore Israel to the former glory. The Hosanna! Welcome to the King of the Jews! But again, in 5 days, where are they all going? Where did they all go? They're not standing up for Jesus then, when it appears that his kingship is about to be ended because he's about to die. They had a misunderstanding. They were devoted. They were very passionate and in a fervor about this awesome King Jesus, but they did not have any idea what that really meant. They did not appropriately understand what they were saying when this happened. John 12, 32 through 34. This is how we know they didn't understand, right? When I am lifted, this is Jesus talking, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show what kind of death he was going to die. So the crowd answered him, "We have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" They didn't understand, right? They didn't understand what was going to be happening, and how many people today misunderstand or mistake the message of Jesus for something that it never was. In their time, they were thinking of Jesus as this conquering king, even though Jesus told them specifically it wasn't going to be that way. They twisted it. They misunderstood. They were definitely passionate. They were definitely engaged. They were definitely motivated, but they did not understand the message Jesus was saying, despite their great passion for him. And how many people today have that same problem? People who are passionate, who are excited, who are energetic about Jesus, but who do not understand the message. So we see hatred, we see ignorance. Despite their belief at this point, what did they do a week later, right? They abandoned him because that ignorance did not prepare them for what was going to happen. Number three, people responded with either unbelief or weak belief. There are a couple of different things. Now, before we get into this, there's a difference, and I already mentioned this a little bit, there's a difference between unbelief and hatred. The Pharisees hated Jesus. They didn't believe in Jesus. But that unbelief in Jesus led them to lash out at those who did. There's a second kind of unbelief, the sort of dispassionate unbelief, right? I don't believe in Jesus, but I don't really care what you do. You just do your own thing, right? We see a different kind of unbelief here as well. John 12, 36 through 40, when Jesus had said these things, he departed, hid himself from them. Though he had done so many signs, they still did not believe in him, so that what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. "Lord, who has believed what he's heard from us? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" Therefore they could not believe, for Isaiah said, "He has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them." Now, to be fair, there was a necessity to their unbelief, because what happens if everybody believes at this point? Remember, this is the week leading up to the crucifixion. If everybody suddenly turns and believes, there's no crucifixion. right? The necessity of God's plan did hinge on their unbelief. But then later then, when he was raised, and then the apostles started preaching and teaching about this Jesus, that unbelief remained. Not everybody turned to him later at the end. Not everybody turned to him later when his resurrection was preached into the world. They still did not care. They still did not believe, even though they saw the signs, even though they saw what the apostles were doing, even though they remembered that Jesus died and then they were told that he rose again. Isaiah said these things because he saw his glory and spoke of him. Nevertheless, many of the authorities believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. I would call this practical unbelief. There's actual unbelief, where you just literally don't believe, but there's also a practical unbelief, where your whatever level of belief that you have does not result in anything different in your life, does not result in any change or any passion or any motivation or any thanksgiving or any love or any of that. None of the fruits of the Spirit, right? This is a practical unbelief. They may have intellectually assented. They may have intellectually absorbed some knowledge. But if your intellectual assent never leads to a transformed life, did it really ever mean anything? I think a lot of people are in this category today. A lot of people who admit or say they believe in Jesus, they'll answer it on all the Gallup polls or the Pew Research. But functionally speaking, practically speaking, their lives are no different than those who really don't believe. There's a practical unbelief that goes along with the actual unbelief of many of the people. Unbelief and practical unbelief, I think, are by far the most common responses to Jesus even today. Most people do not actively hate Jesus or the Christian stuff. Most people don't actively hate that. Most people, I think, either just don't care, or they say they care, but they don't really do anything about it. I think the overwhelming majority. And so we come then to the last question. What response was Jesus looking for then? And what does he continue to desire now? We see some things that are not good responses. Hatred, unbelief, a misguided zeal, right? A zeal that is based on ignorance. We see all those things. What did he actually want? John 12, 25 and 26. Whoever loves his life loses it. Whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me, and where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Three things. Hate your own life. There's a statement of priorities here, right? What did it say about these people? They loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. There's an element of priority switch, right? Jesus is looking for people who will prioritize him above themselves. He was looking for it then, and he's looking for it now. People who will not care about what comes from people, people who will not care what comes from the world, people who will not care what comes from themselves, people who will place themselves lower than Jesus, following Jesus, no matter where it leads. Again, why did those people not want to speak out about their belief in Jesus? Because they were afraid of being put out of the synagogue. Jesus was put out of the synagogue. Jesus was rejected by the Pharisees, and they did not want to follow Jesus into that situation. Jesus is looking for people who will follow him no matter where it might take you, no matter what circumstance that might lead you into. Jesus is looking for the kind of people who will follow him even if it leads to death. And then finally, people who will serve him, who will work on his behalf to further not what they want. See, again, there's a disconnect here, right? A lot of people think they're serving Jesus, but they're working for their own benefit, right? They're working for the benefit of maybe their parents or their preacher or their whoever. Jesus wants people who will work on his behalf for his benefit, not for their own benefit. That idea of service, right? John 12, 35 and 36 Jesus said to them, "The light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light." Now, he's using the term light here to describe his physical presence, right? The light is among you a little while. Well, in a little while, literally like 5 days, that light's going to leave. He's going to die, then he'll raise, and then later on after that, he'll ascend, right? It's going to be, the light is not going to be among them forever. However, John uses the same terminology decades later when he's writing another letter, the first letter, the first John. These are all written by the same people, right? We've got, I can't do what Loy does. Loy calls them Big John and Little Johns. So we've got the first Little John, 1 John 1:6 and 7, same terminology, right? If we say that we have fellowship with him while we walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of his son, Jesus, cleanses us from all sin. This idea of walking, right? Oops. This idea of walking in light or darkness, changing the way you live your life, going to a different place, having a different destination, deciding to do some different things. That is what Jesus is demanding, right? That's the response that Jesus wanted. There was hatred, there was unbelief, there was practical unbelief, there was misguided, ignorant zeal, there was passionate people who didn't know what they were saying. Jesus wants people who will serve him, work on his best interests, who will walk as he walked, do the things that he did, teach the things that he taught, who will forsake whatever benefits them in lieu of seeking that which benefits Jesus, who will hate their own lives, and who will follow him wherever that might lead. That's what he was looking for then. That's what he's looking for now. Now, in this cauldron of emotions, we see a lot of different factors moving parts. Jesus' last week on earth is going to unfold dramatically and momentously. A lot of things are going to happen in the next 9 chapters, in the next 6 or 7 days. A lot of things are going to take place in this sort of bubbling cauldron of different people, right? Different people with different agendas and different desires and different sort of beliefs about Jesus, and it all is going to mix together into this explosive thing that ultimately will end in what? The death of your Savior. For your benefit, I might add. He did, goes through all this stuff for you, so that you might have forgiveness and redemption. And as we're going to go through these next 9 chapters of John, that's what we need to have firmly placed in our minds, right? That he does all of this for us so that we might have a chance at redemption. Just offering us the chance. He doesn't even know if you're going to take it or not. He offers you that chance. Will you accept his terms? The consequences of that week echo through the ages, and the response that people have today is very similar to the response that people have then. People still hate Jesus. People still follow him in misguided ways. People still don't believe or just refuse to care. Or people have this practical unbelief. Maybe they admit it, acknowledge it mentally, but it doesn't do anything in their lives. That's not what Jesus is looking for. He's looking for the kind of people who will forsake everything and follow him. And the question then must be, have you done that? Are you willing to accept his terms, to follow him in his ways, to do the things that benefit him, even if it's at the cost of your own life?